It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
Tonight, explosions like this across Lebanon. As the Hezbollah militant group says, hundreds of pagers belonging to its members detonated simultaneously, calling it a massive coordinated attack and blaming Israel.
It was, by any measure, one of the most astonishing espionage operations anybody can recall. A modern-day Trojan horse. All across Lebanon this week, thousands of pagers imported by Hezbollah and distributed to its operatives blew up simultaneously, sending shockwaves through the region and creating a healthcare crisis as badly injured fighters and not a few civilians poured into emergency rooms, many of them screaming in agony, their faces burned, their hands severed. It has since been confirmed from U.S. intelligence officials that Israeli intelligence did indeed conduct this operation, apparently creating a front company where the Hezbollah pagers were secretly stuffed with high-powered explosives that could be triggered from Tel Aviv. But where and exactly how did the Israelis manage to pull this off without anybody from Hezbollah having a clue? And what impact will it have in a Mideast already boiling over with tensions? We'll talk to Tom Bossert, a cybersecurity and counterterrorism expert who once served as White House Homeland Security Advisor under President Trump, on this episode of Spy Talk. Tom Bossert, welcome to Spy Talk. I was trying to think of the perfect expert to talk about this Israeli operation against Hezbollah, and I immediately thought of you. You're a cybersecurity expert. You run your own company, Cyber Defense. You were once the Homeland Security Advisor for President Trump during his first 2 years in office. Give me your reaction when you first heard about what the Israelis had done with these pagers in Lebanon.
Michael, you thought about the best and then you settled on me. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. Good to be with you. Listen, I can't miss the opportunity to realize the seriousness of the situation and the unfolding nature of it. And so I want to not be glib about it. I want to start by being relatively serious and noting that we've got an escalatory environment in which the whole world might be brought into an armed conflict and in which people are dying every day. So that said, I have to confess that the first thing I thought was that it was unbelievable. I almost didn't believe the reporting. And maybe I'm conditioned now to question the source of everything, but yesterday when we talked, I thought maybe I made a joke or two. I said, it really blows my mind, but I don't want to make that the headline that I'm making light of this. But this is probably the, at least in my recollection, the widest scale attack of this nature I can think of in history. Awfully pinpoint, incredibly tailored use of force. I can't think of another example of such a tailored use of force. Now, there's been reporting that two children were injured in this attack, but or in this set of attacks. I guess we've now learned there's been a secondary round of radio walkie-talkie detonations. But it seems like this was the most pinpoint use of force against members of a terrorist organization that I can recall.
You know, a lot of questions about how the Israelis managed to pull this off. You know, the pagers that blew up bear the logo Gold Apollo, which is a Taiwanese company. The Taiwanese company said they had nothing to do with this. They were licensed by a Hungarian company, BAC. When the Washington Post reporters in Budapest tried to find the headquarters, they found an empty building. Nobody was there. Yeah, and just the magnitude of being able to stuff explosives into thousands of pagers. I'm just trying to imagine what that looked like, how it was done, where it was done. Give me your thoughts about, you know, how something like this could have been pulled off.
Yeah, the topics range from strategic to tactical to logistics, right? And yeah, it would seem in the pagers that the most logical place inside a device like that, probably a lot of people listening to this remember pagers, probably a lot of people don't in the podcast era, but I confess I carried one at some point. You probably did too in your career.
many years ago.
Right. Think about the size of that relatively antiquated technology. And the only place really, the only room within which you have to operate to put explosives, which requires some space, some volume, is probably the battery compartment. Now, I don't have any insight into this. I'm no longer receiving intelligence, but I do work with a lot of people who have done this kind of thing for a living. And, you know, I think all of us immediately suspected that they've used the batteries or battery compartments to house the explosives. And that begs a lot of questions. It's kind of, I'm going to go down the path of why this is brilliant for the Israelis. And then we can come back later and talk about the risks, the trade-offs. But from an Israeli perspective, think about what they've done here. They have introduced fear into every member of Hezbollah, right? They're looking over their shoulder for years now, thinking that everything they touch might blow up. I can't imagine, just as a human being, right? They're probably looking at everything they pull out of their pockets and everything that they have in their house and everything that they touch on a daily basis. Their toothbrush is now a bomb in their mind on a day like today. They've also disrupted command and control, which I think is the real point. And they've probably made them nervous about telecommunications or any kind of communications.
Yeah, just breaking in on that, I'm looking at reporting today, which, by the way, you know, the death toll is up to 37 with over 3,000 wounded. But according, I think this is a Reuters report, panicked residents are abandoning their mobile phones. Quote, "This isn't a small matter. It's war. Who can even secure their phones now? When I heard about what happened yesterday, I left my phone on my motorcycle and walked away," said Mustafa Sabal on a street near central Beirut, which is, you know, perhaps representative of the reaction among people in Lebanon and certainly Hezbollah as well.
Yeah, you know, if that person's an innocent Lebanese civilian, you hate to hear that. If that person's a avowed member of a terrorist organization, which, by the way, the United States has considered a terrorist organization since 1997,
considered Hezbollah a terrorist organization.
then I'm pretty pleased with that outcome. If the more nervous they are, the more they think twice about membership, much less attacking Israel or anyone else, the better for me.
Well, but,
you know, there's a fear there. There's an operational effect there. And there's a trust issue, you know, so back to your question about logistics, we don't know yet exactly how they intervened in the supply chain of things, whether it was at the factory or whether it was during shipping that they intercepted these pagers and modified them. And think about this. If I'm Nasrallah and the leadership of Hezbollah, I'm now not trusting people that are in my inner circle, because there's a very good chance that the Israelis had human beings shape this outcome. Of course, the Israelis were doing a lot of things to cause Hezbollah to distrust their phones, hacking them, intercepting the signals, listening to their conversations. But it's very, very possible that people inside that decision process were intentionally suggesting that they move to pagers, knowing the Israeli capability to plant explosives in them.
The reporting is, Tom, that Nasrallah himself was urging the switch to pagers because of concerns that the Israelis were surveilling and intercepted their communications.
Well, you know how that works, though, right? Who had the idea first, him or his number two?
And who in that conversation then told
the Israelis? And were the quartermasters that buy their supplies in on it? I think that Hezbollah right now is not only suffering disruption to their command and control and communications capability, but suffering a massive internal trust problem. And I think that's exactly what the Israelis wanted.
Well, that does raise the question of where this goes from here. And you referenced the concerns about escalatory attacks. You know, Hezbollah leaders have already vowed bloody, unique revenge for this operation. Nasrallah, as we speak, is scheduled to give a speech later today, in which I'm sure he will say, make comments along those lines. Let's talk about the trade-offs here for an operation like this, when, you know, part of the blowback could be a serious escalation of the war on Israel's northern front.
Well, a lot of players here, right? You talk about Nasrallah. Let's introduce to the listeners that Hassan Nasrallah is the leader of Hezbollah, both its political arm and its paramilitary arm. That has been designated a terrorist organization by the United States and its allies for a very long time. And remember that Hezbollah has killed Americans and has a lot of American blood on its hands. Hezbollah killed Marines in 1983 in Beirut. You'll remember that. And they've been behind dozens of attacks since. You can go to the State Department website, and we list it out pretty nicely there as a government. So the question is, what's different about whatever rhetoric we hear from Nasrallah? And at the time of this recording, I think he's set to make public remarks in a few hours. And he very well could, out of anger and emotion, announce things that he can't enforce. Or he might call for a massive escalation. And I suspect he's under a considerable amount of pressure from the Iranian leadership, both his spiritual, you know, these are Shia organizations, and operational leader and financial backer. And so, you know, where could this go? I mean, Lebanon should not want, its political leadership should not want an escalation. But Hezbollah from Lebanon has been launching attacks, deadly attacks into Israel ever since October 7th in solidarity with the Palestinian residents in Gaza, and in solidarity with Hamas, who stands for the extermination of Israel. So what does Israel have to worry about? I think Israel should be cautious and worried, I suppose, although they have every right to do this, about drawing Iran in and launching us into major escalation, international armed conflict. And then what does Hamas want? There's a strong argument that Sinwar, the Hamas leader, wants that. He has turned down every ceasefire request in and around Ramadan and in and around times where he should be taking opportunities to de-escalate in his own self-interest. And it seems counterintuitive unless he wants this to escalate. And so you've got multiple parties, and you've got this big international calculus. And I know it's a bit of a longer answer, but think of it this way. We don't know, as we talk here today, enough. The Israelis certainly are closer to this matter. We don't know whether they are trying to get Hezbollah to stop their regular attacks, deadly attacks, into the north of Israel, whether they had a strong indication that there was active planning for a larger attack that they just disrupted, or some third thing. So was this to de-escalate? Was this to interrupt Or was this to prepare for a military that you see this in the news today? Was this for them as a first strike matter to prepare the battle space for a military invasion where the IDF would move across their border into Lebanon? Remember, there's tens of thousands, I don't want to get my numbers wrong, but tens of thousands of Israelis that have been displaced from their homes in northern Israel.
Yeah, I think it's 60,000 is the number the Israelis have used.
Imagine 60,000 Americans moved out of an area the size of northern New Jersey. And the pressure politically and in a sense of fairness from a humanitarian perspective to get them back to their homes.
And yeah, so, I mean, that said, Tom, all right, the U.S., the Biden administration has consistently said it supports Israel's right to defend itself. When Iran fired hundreds of drones and missiles towards Israel, the United States helped the Israelis intercept those missiles and prevent casualties to civilians. But this was an aggressive move by the Israelis. If this sets off a wider escalation, a more heated war, is the U.S. government prepared, or should it be prepared, to defend Israel or help Israel militarily with the consequences of a aggressive move that it made unilaterally without even informing the U.S. ahead of time?
Yeah, this tactic that they used was a fairly pinpoint, although extraordinary, I guess, technique. But I don't think this constitutes something out of left field where the Israelis did something that was so shockingly unpredictable. They're in the middle, from their perspective, they're in the middle of a two-front war. And I don't think anybody in the U.S. National security firmament found this to be an outrage that they would do something like this without telling us. I suspect that Secretary Blinken and President Biden are a bit disappointed in that we are supporting, and I think rightfully, the Israelis with arms and financial support. But I don't know if I'd phrase the question that way, Michael. I think the answer is the government's ready to support Israel should this escalate. And I think other governments, allied governments, are as well. The question for me, I think about a lot, is whether the U.S. Public is prepared to support something of that nature, especially something without a day two plan. If this escalates into a full-fledged Iranian war against Israel and all that that entails with U.S. involvement in the middle of this election cycle, I suspect the country would be pretty deeply divided.
And especially if it happens in real time in the midst of a presidential campaign. You used the word pinpoint. Let me read you a tweet from Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the wake of this attack. Israel's pager attack in Lebanon detonated thousands of handheld devices across a slew of public spaces, seriously injuring and killing innocent civilians. This attack clearly and unequivocally violates international humanitarian law and undermines U.S. efforts to prevent a wider conflict. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think she's got that wrong. One of the things that it's a hallmark of international law and U.S. application of it for decades now, and I've been counterterrorism and homeland security advisor not only to President Trump, but also President Bush. And I've worked quite collegially with Presidents Obama and Biden and their teams, and I think all of them across that very wide spectrum of worldviews feel comfortable in our application of international law to groups of people. And I think that stems back in history to, you know, Thomas Aquinas. You know, the use of force here has to be tailored and discriminatory and so forth. But that discrimination stops when you sign up to an adversary's military and put on their uniform, or when you sign up to a terrorist organization whose avowed purpose is to hurt, destroy, or harm, and in this case, use terrorist tactics to do it. So The question, I guess, I would ask the congresswoman is, does she believe that people who join the Hezbollah paramilitary arm deserve to be guilty by their choice of joining that organization? And if they are, and that is how we apply law, then what is wrong with doing anything at all in use of force back to them?
The problem here is that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization, according to the U.S. government and most European governments as well, the EU. But it's also a political party. It also provides social services and has all sorts of, you know, civilians working with it, for it, that are not necessarily part of the, you know, paramilitary force that's firing rockets at Israel. You know, when it's a broader organization than just the terrorist arm, you know, are there humanitarian considerations that need to be factored in?
I mean, that's kind of asked and answered, in my view. I think the notion that this terrorist organization has now run for political office and received political support from a broad enough swath of Lebanese people does not mean that they've become a Jeffersonian democracy, and that we have to start thinking through an individual prosecution of each person's intent. We've got an ability right now to discern. But in this case, members of Hezbollah in a designated group and a designated list are, I'll just say, fair targets because they've made us unfair targets. Now, the place where I think she might have made a stronger case, if I were her, is to question whether there could be collateral damage, whether there was a child next to someone who, by virtue of being a child.
Well, I think that is, I think, her point.
Not as you read that tweet to me. Yeah. I'll go back and reread it, but
seriously injuring and killing innocent civilians.
Well, if she thinks 3,000 Hezbollah members are innocent civilians, then she and I just fundamentally see the world differently.
We'll now take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. And we're back. Let me take you back a little to the trade craft here, because you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you're a cybersecurity guy. You spend a lot, that's what you do for a living. You run your own cyber defense company now. You wrote a piece back in 2020 for the New York Times, an op-ed, in which you talked about the Russians hacking into the United States, and you specifically referenced the SolarWinds cyber attack, in which the Russians apparently got into the software, and you highlighted the concern about a supply chain interruption or intervention here. You wrote, "This is what is called the supply chain attack, meaning the pathway into the target networks rely on access to a supplier. Supply chain attacks require significant resources and sometimes years to execute. They are most always the product of a nation state." This seems to have been a supply chain attack through the front company in Hungary. Again, there are a lot of details we still don't know at this point. But the point you were making there about to pull something like this off, it could take years to execute. That doesn't seem to square with at least what we know, the timeline here, which was earlier this year, months ago, Nasrallah was talking about bringing in the pagers and getting rid of cell phones. So process this for me. Tell me.
Yeah, sure. Well, this is the sub story, right? When you get past the international conflict analysis and counterterrorism analysis, supply chain is going to become the persistent story here. I think you already saw it this morning. Some have reacted by escalating their calls on the U.S. government to onshore the manufacture of critical technology. How do you trust something that might pass through two, or its components might pass through two, three, or even 10 countries in the manufacturing process? Someone asked, I think, a good question. Have the Israelis opened Pandora's box here? What type of fear might spread unintendedly into the rest of the world? At some stage, are there people in the United States afraid to pick up their phone for fear that it'll blow up on them? And, there's just so many differences here. I think the short answer is, to directly answer your question, the Russia, and it was Russia behind SolarWinds cyber attack, in the case of SolarWinds, required huge amounts of time planning and execution to find vulnerabilities in software, to exploit them, to plant them into new software updates in an otherwise innocent company. And I think SolarWinds being vilified is ridiculous, because they're the victim. But there's a lot of similarities to it, and part of it is planning, and part of it is making something look, whether it's software or, in this case, a piece of hardware, not only look like what it's supposed to be, but actually function in the way it's originally intended, while also serving your purpose, whether it be in SolarWinds, a means to gain access to a network, or in this case, to serve as a bomb. I mean, remember, these pagers, for months, I would assume, at very least weeks, but it would seem like logic would suggest that these pagers have been in use. Maybe you've seen it reported for months and months, and actually functioning and working as a pager. That means it has to withstand scrutiny. People have to be able to look at it, open the battery compartment, not see anything obvious. You can't have wires and things sticking out of it. I mean, nobody would trust it. So it's remarkable. That's why I think they probably converted one or both of the batteries into something of the explosive compartment.
By the way, how did it get through, you know, standard security? I assume that these Hezbollah operatives might have taken airplane flights, might have, you know, entered secure buildings. They go through x-rays, and holding these pagers packed with explosives, nothing goes off.
Right. So that's the point I'm making. You've got to make these things actually work and function as they're designed, in this case, like a pager or a walkie-talkie, and serve as a bomb, in this case, some other separate purpose. With software, that's a lot easier to do. You hide a line of code. With this, there's a degree of wizardry or tradecraft here, which goes to my point earlier about fear, trust, and things that are more ethereal, right? The message I think that Israel sent to Hezbollah today is going to make a lot of their lower level operatives think twice.
Yeah, but you said something that parrot one of your phrases kind of blew my mind, which is the consequences for something like this, well beyond the Israeli Hezbollah conflict, of people around the world starting to be concerned that their cell phones or devices could blow up. I'm just like, look, you are a Homeland Security advisor.
I'm seeing it already. I get where you're going. I don't think there's reason to get that excited right now. I want to make sure I don't endorse that view.
Well, you put it out there. So.
Well, I mean, that's the question. Have they opened Pandora's box? Is a bit of a catchy line, but it takes quite a bit of effort and quite a bit of tradecraft to pull off something like that. I mean, the flip side of what we're talking about is to do this at mass scale without being detected, and for it to function both as designed and as altered, is incredibly time and money intensive, right?
So yeah, I'm still just trying to imagine the Mossad operatives in Hungary stuffing thousands of pagers with explosives. I mean, what that looked like, you know.
Well, this is why I talk about human trust, right? Perhaps they had already long before discovered a way of taking what looks like two AA batteries and putting something of a much smaller lithium ion battery inside of them and stuffing the remaining space with an explosive chemicals that react in an explosive way. That kind of stuff happens over a long period of time. And so it's hard to imagine although it's possible that they just got lucky, that Nasrallah decided to move to pagers and that they just so happened to have some technology around that they could hurry up and stuff in the back of these pagers in their shipping route.
I think they
shaped that outcome. And if you think about that, whatever your views of the violence here, it's a brilliant set of tradecraft.
You were a Homeland Security advisor at the White House. You worked with the intel community across the board, especially on cyber stuff. I mean, had you ever heard talk of or discussions about planning some kind of operation like this? Was this ever on the drawing board of U.S. intelligence?
Yeah, things like this have... apropos to the name of this podcast, things like this have been in spycraft for a very long time. My good friend Chris Costa, who runs the Spy Museum, has an entire museum in Washington, D.C. full of neat little tricks and gadgets, a lot of which were designed to, you know, look like a pen, but actually serve as a dagger or a poison delivery method or, you know, James Bond type stuff. That's real. And in the Bush administration, I was part of a team of people who developed our first cyber strategy, and there's an entire section dedicated to supply chain management. And so we've been looking at and trying to figure
ways. Was
that
supply chain management for defense or for offense such as this?
Well, you know, of course, when you know what you can do, you know what the adversary can do. So it's a little bit of both. Let's just say people in classified settings are constantly modifying products and goods for some intelligence collection purpose if they can do it. Think of this in the Trump administration. I was part of the team that led to banning Huawei, a Chinese producer of telecom gear, because in our view, there was no way to look at the nanometer level chipsets to see whether they had implants in them, and to wide scale adopt technology from a country who would readily exploit that by putting things inside all of those chips that could spy on Americans made them too large a risk to use. You know, the British thought about it.
But Tom, that's spying. That's surveillance.
Okay.
What the Israelis did here was aggressive, offensive warfare through a pager.
Yeah. Well, I hear what you're saying. And I always go back to setting the stage for people listening. These are not innocent civilians, as the congresswoman suggested. These are members of a vicious and violent, heinous terrorist organization who kills innocent people as a political tactic. We did, or the Israelis there did a couple of things. They hurt their ability to communicate, which is fair. And they caused fear in their adversary, which is fair. And they caused mistrust among its leadership, which is fair. Let me broaden it. If this was any conversation about use of force, I'd go through my analysis, and I've used this with multiple presidents. Any kind of use of force has to be just, necessary, and effective. It has to be. And just is a whole body of law. Just means, boiled down for these listeners, you know, it's a whole bunch of international law and a lot of words, but it really means self-defense, defense of others, or in retaliation to or against someone who violates the conventions against WMD or genocide. Those are really the big four. And if someone does that, it's just to use force in response. That doesn't mean it's necessary, and it certainly doesn't mean it'll be effective. And I think we learned that in Iraq and Afghanistan. Use of force was just and justified, and it might have even been necessary, at least given the intelligence at the time the decisions were made. But it clearly wasn't effective in achieving our desired outcomes, at least not in both countries. So, you know, people get this. People get this in their regular lives. Sometimes I use silly analogies and get in trouble for them. But if you're sitting alone in a bar one night and a really big guy, 8 foot tall, comes in and starts abusing someone small, you might have an instinct to defend that person. And the law would say you're right. If you got up and punched that guy in the face, you were defending someone, use of force in self-defense or defense of others is okay, even in an interpersonal level, not just an international one. You might not do it, though. It might not be necessary for you to get up and do that. You might have some other means, like calling the police or screaming or whatever. But I'll tell you, the other thing is it might not be effective. I don't know about you, but I'm not looking to go and fight an 8-foot-tall guy right now and think I'm going to win. But you might do it anyway. Those are the three rules, Tom Bossert rules on the use of force. Okay, if you want to break it down, just, necessary, and effective. And I think the Israelis had all those predicates to go after Hezbollah.
Well, you're talking to somebody who spent a lifetime avoiding fights in bars. So,
I'm glad, like I said, the best person for your
analogy there. But let me broaden it, this discussion, for just a few moments in a couple of other directions. You became Homeland Security Advisor in early 2017 in the aftermath of the Russian interference in the 2016 election, something mm-hmm. you tried repeatedly to lecture your boss about, who wasn't always receptive to it. But since then, foreign adversary efforts to interfere in our politics has only accelerated, and we've seen more and more examples of it, both by the Russians and other nation-state actors, prominently Iran. Let me read you about a story that just broke early Thursday morning as we're taping this. This is from NBC News. Iranians sent, quote, unsolicited emails that included stolen material that was not publicly available from former President Trump's campaign to people associated with his Democratic political rival, the FBI and two other government agencies, said Wednesday. The FBI and officials from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency said there was currently no information indicating that recipients associated with Biden's campaign had responded to the emails, which government officials condemned as part of an effort to, quote, stoke discord and undermine confidence in our electoral process. This seems to take matters a bit beyond what the Russians did in 2016 by not just hacking campaign emails from Trump, but then providing them to the political rival of Donald
It's terrible. It's unacceptable. I'm not sure if it's farther, though, because you'll remember all of the information that got released through WikiLeaks and how ridiculous it was, I thought, then and now, for President Trump to seemingly endorse it because it seemed to help his cause. I mean, this is the problem. You have to take a strong, consistent line on what is unacceptable. Because it has to be good for the goose and the gander. It has to be an equivocal defense of our democratic system and our sovereignty. And it can't be okay when it benefits you politically. And it can't be not okay when it doesn't. And so I am not happy that this has happened. If this is true, I'm just hearing of the news. Of course, you just read it to me, but I'm not surprised. It's consistent with their tradecraft and the intelligence that we've been seeing and hearing out of U.S. institutions.
But what do we do about it? I mean, you know, look, sanctioned the Russians, you know, left and right because of the invasion of Ukraine. Of course, we had started sanctioning them well before because of both their intervention in 2014 and what they did in 2016. Obviously, it hasn't deterred the Russians from doing what they are doing. We've imposed plenty of sanctions on the Iranians as well. I mean, what as a country can we do? You're a cyber defense guy.
Yeah.
What do we do about this when, you know, it just continues and escalates?
Yeah, well, I'll give a shameless plug for my company in a minute because we have come up with an incredibly new and disruptive technology that can help. But before I go there, what we do is we recognize that there's an adversary. We don't talk about cyber defense as if it's just a bunch of controls. We do innovate, and I've come up with an innovation that's I think the world will hear of pretty soon here. It's pretty effective and disruptive in the industry. But we need to impose penalties on the people. And so sometimes I've agreed with, I think, Dmitry Ablarovich, one of the founders of CrowdStrike, was the first to say this. We don't necessarily have a cyber problem. We have a Russia, Iran, North Korea problem. They're the most frequent offenders of this. So there's a lot you have to do. You have to go after them. And you've just pointed out the limitations of economic sanctions. I will point out, though, that there's a difference between the sanctions that we imposed in the past for this type of behavior and the type of sanctions that we have imposed. This is a historic point, by the way, not just a recent observation. Jeffrey Sonnenfeld at Yale put out some research on this. I direct your listeners to that. But the difference between those sanctions and what we've imposed on the Russians for their invasion of Ukraine is that there's pretty much complete societal support for it. And so the government imposing sanctions is one thing, and the Russians have been able to withstand the pain of them. But when a lot of companies join in voluntarily, and when a lot of other countries join at the same time, that imposes real pain. It has an effect on the Russians. Don't be fooled to think otherwise. And in fact, every application of sanctions in history that have worked have been sanctions that had global unanimous support. Once everyone turns their back on a country for behaving this way, they can no longer succeed. And I think it's time for a lot of our partners in Europe to face that. And a lot of the people who are dependent on supplies and resources from Russia and Iran and North Korea and China to start to redistribute their supply chains, because over time we're gonna have no choice but to come to a place of turning our collective backs on them, imposing real economic pain. Otherwise, we're going to be at war, Michael, and increasingly, that is a terrifying prospect in a world of near-peer capabilities and nuclear weapons.
Last question for you. We are in the last weeks of a very heated presidential campaign. You worked for one of the candidates, Donald Trump, as his Homeland Security advisor. You tried, without much success, to impress upon him the seriousness of what the Russians had done, and yet notoriously in Helsinki, he seemed to accept Vladimir Putin's word over what you and others in the U.S. intelligence community were telling him. Quite a few of those who work closely for President Trump say they can no longer support him and plan to vote for Kamala Harris. Where you stand?
Well, that's a nice try. Shortly after 9/11, President Bush made a challenge to about 3,000 of us, which sounds like a lot of people, but it was a pretty small room in my memory, that if we wanted to have anything to do with or be a part of the Homeland Security at the time, not just department, but community that we were creating, having security professionals focusing domestically, that we had to stop any affiliation with our partisan, otherwise civic duty. And there were a lot of people that said, hey, listen, I'm going to remain partisan. I'm going to stay involved in party politics and write checks to candidates and be active and so on. And he said, that's fine, but you're going to have to go work in another place or another department or a different field if you want to work for Maine. I took a different tact and have been as nonpartisan, not bipartisan. That's not a thing, but nonpartisan as possible since. But I'm struck with a lot of concerns on the national security front. I am not a nationalist or an isolationist or a protectionist, and those tendencies in President Trump are troubling to me.
That would suggest that you are not prepared to vote for him this November. I'm not hearing or seeing a response, Tom.
Well, you know, as I said, one of the things that allows me the trust and hopefully the ability to lead others in this community, but one of the things that allows me the trust of advising multiple presidents, had a very unique career in this regard, and I'm blessed for it. Is to not get sucked into things like that. But I do give you my view, and I think it's something that people should take seriously when they vote. That those three isms are not only destructive in the long run. They are not consistent with our founding principles.
Okay. Well, Tom Bossert, I want to thank you. I should have mentioned in the intro, you are currently the president of Trinity Cyber, and you seem to hint that you've got something perhaps of significance that you're going to unleash upon the world. I assume it's not exploding pagers, but we will, of course, be eager to hear about it.
Thanks, and you will soon. It's time for us to fully open, fully interrogate, and then actively remove threats to networks and data from network traffic at scale on live network traffic. And we've got the technology that for the first time allows that to happen. And it, I think, will be in short order the next generation of network security that will replace some pretty big household names.
Great. Thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us. Great discussion.
Michael, as always, thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.com news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance, or don't understand the differences between insurance plans, or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.